So I'm going to call to order the Senate Interim Committee on General Government and Accountability. This is December, no, this is not December the 11th. This is December 12th. Thank you. December 12th, and we'll come to order. I'm going to start with a work session for introduction of committee legislative concepts. But before I do that, I want to ask the members if they have any bills that they want to add to the committee bills, any concepts they want to add to the committee bills.
Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chair, the only bill is a redraft of this bill, so I don't know if would this be appropriate for this committee or...
It would be okay for the committee, but it is not an LC that's drafted yet, and it has to be, I believe.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Manning, you'd submit a request for a redraft of that measure, right. And then when we have the LC, we'd be able to introduce it.
Then we can add it, yeah. Okay. The chair moves that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. Before I do that, a vote for introduction is not a vote on the merits of the content and the concept, nor does it guarantee that the concept will be referred back to this committee, nor that it will be scheduled for a hearing, and it doesn't indicate that anyone voting for this is actually for the bill. It's just a procedure to allow it to be heard. Doesn't indicate that you will vote for it or against it. It's simply a procedure bill. So I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 2319, dated October 15, 2018. LC 2741, dated November 8, 2018. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? They are introduced. So now we move into informational meetings, and I'm just going to follow the order that's on the agenda. So we're going to look at a preview of other potential concepts and priorities, and if Rob Bovet, Adam Crawford, and Ginger McCall could come up. So I didn't open that. I'm going to open this informational system.
Chair Riley, senators, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Bovet, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. I think I'm going to go first because I only have two things to mention to you real quickly. And then I think Ginger's going to go next. And then Adam, who has the long list, is going to go last. So we have, you'll be seeing two bills from the Association of Oregon Counties that address technical problems with the statutes relating to county governance. I suspect, strongly suspect, they'll come to this committee, but who knows? So I'm just going to briefly explain what each of those two are. We just got the LC draft back on one. I didn't have time to get it to Cheyenne, so it's not on OLIS, but I can certainly get it to you later. And I'll just mention the two of them real briefly. One of them relates to the terms of office for county commissioner and the staggering of those terms. So in Oregon law, much like any other board or commission, Oregon law provides for staggering of the terms of county commissions. So you have generally, if a county commission consists of three commissioners, two of them are on one cycle, one of them is on another cycle. The idea here, of course, is a matter of policy to have continuity of operation. So you don't have an entire board leaving or coming on at the same time. But there's a problem that has arisen in the last two decades, and we've seen it manifest itself. And let me explain the brief problem. So when we have a vacancy in the office of county commissioner in a county that does not have a charter, which is all but nine, then generally what happens is if there's enough time to fill, such as 2 years or more, we have an election to fill that position, the remaining vacancy, which is very similar to your offices as well. But the way that statute is written, it keys off of a general election, in other words, November of an even-numbered year. But there's been another thing happening at the same time as all of this has been going on, which is there has been a large trend throughout Oregon to convert county commission positions from partisan to nonpartisan. In fact, the overwhelming majority of county voters have converted their county commissions to nonpartisan. So why do you care? What that means is that in many cases, county commissioners are being elected outright in the primary, in the May election. It never gets to the general election. So what can happen theoretically, and now it's happened in at least one county in reality, is you can have someone or some people running for election to fill the remaining term of someone who left office. They should theoretically get, say, a two-year term to retain the stagger that's in statute. But because the stagger statute keys off of the general election and the general election was disposed of, they get a brand new four-year term. As a result, in at least one county, we have all three commissioners on the same term of office, so we could have a complete cycle. So we would like to fix that statute in recognition of the fact that most county commission positions have converted to nonpartisan. And we're not talking about shortening existing people's terms of office. We're talking about restoring staggers in the next cycle, as was originally the case. So you'll see a bill to do that. We haven't got that bill back yet. It's at legislative council. The second one I'll mention really only affects 9 Oregon counties, and those are the counties with charters. So much like the state has a constitution and you have state laws, you can initiate changes to either state law or a county charter so that people can do an initiative process. Tougher standards to make changes to the Oregon Constitution, got to get more signatures, got to meet higher level tests for what can be in the Constitution than what can be in state law. Same is true at a local level. So the initiative process applies to local governments as well. So people can initiate local laws by initiative petition. We call them ordinances. But in charter counties, you can also initiate amendments to the charter, which is the fundamental document for a county, much like the Constitution is for the state. So to amend a charter, only the people can amend a charter by a vote. So you can initiate amendments to a charter. But the way state law currently reads, before an approved petition is circulated for signatures to get enough signatures for a ballot, county clerks, with their assistance of their county attorneys, test those ballot measures, local ballot measures, for compliance with the single subject rule, which you are all, I'm sure, quite familiar with, which is a very broad standard. They just, everything in the bill has to just somehow relate to the relating to clause, pretty much, very broad standard. And it has to comply with, at least as to local initiatives, what's called the legislative versus administrative test. What is absent there is testing at pre-circulation for compliance with what's called the separate vote requirement. This prevents folks from essentially log rolling multiple ballot measures into the same ballot measures when we talk about amending a fundamental document like the Constitution or a charter. And so what has happened, at least in one county, is we've had a petition for a charter amendment approved by the clerk because it passed the single subject rule. It passed the administrative legislative rule, and the circulators, the petitioners, got all the thousands and thousands of signatures necessary. Then they file with the clerk, and the clerk says, now, belatedly, the statute tells me to look at separate vote requirement, and yours doesn't pass. And you can imagine the chief petitioners of that particular petition were more than a little upset, because their only options were to take the clerk to court and try to challenge that finding or start over. So what we are proposing, and it just came out of LC as an LC draft, is that the clerk be allowed to test charter amendments for compliance with the separate vote requirement as well, so people can find out if their proposed initiative petition is actually going to make it to the ballot in advance. And if they're not happy with the clerk's ruling, they can test it in court just like before. But at least we test it before all of those signatures are gathered and people wind up wasting a lot of time, money, and energy. So that bill will likely come to you, possibly to rules. I'm not sure where that will wind up. But those are two, we think, important technical clarifications of statutes that need to occur. Happy to answer any questions you might have.
So I have a couple just about things that you mentioned while you were going through that.
Okay.
And that's the legislative administrative test. Explain that to me and explain why it exists.
Mr. Chair, sure. So this is probably more unique to local ballot measures.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and case law basically establishes that the initiative process, which is protected by the Oregon Constitution, has been protected since 1902, basically says that what you can put on a ballot for people to approve and be codified in ordinance or in a county charter is really legislative in character. It says what people can and can't do, sets forth processes, sets forth what you and I would think of as law. It doesn't do things like, say, thou shalt hire Joe Schmo as the county administrator. That's an administrative action. And county clerks would, I think that's probably an extreme example, but you get the point. County clerks would reject, based on case law, an initiative petition directing the county to hire a specific person in a specific position. That's an administrative personnel action, not a legislative action. In other words, things that you would see in terms of legislation would be a legislative action. So that's the kind of short, quick answer. I can get into it deeper if you want, but that's the gist of it.
Make an appointment to explain all that to me.
You bet.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Senators, for inviting me to speak to you today regarding the legislative concepts of the Public Records Advisory Council. My name is Ginger McCall, and I'm the Public Records Advocate for the State of Oregon and the Chair of the Public Records Advisory Council. Both the Council and my office, the Office of the Public Records Advocate, were created by the legislature in 2017. The Council is composed of a mix of representatives of the requester community and representatives of government. Since the Council began meeting a little over a year ago, it has been very active. The Council interviewed candidates to be the first Public Records Advocate and recommended three potential candidates to Governor Brown for her review. Since the Office of the Public Records Advocate opened in April 2018, the Council has met four times to assist and advise in setting up the office. The Council has reviewed draft administrative rules for the office, engaged in substantive feedback on the office's training and other activities, agreed upon two legislative proposals, provided substantive feedback to the Department of Administrative Services on a draft public records fee policy, and drafted a survey on public records practices, which will be distributed to public bodies across the state. It has frequently been a forum in which government and requesters could discuss ideas and collaborate on potential public records reforms. The Council has two proposed pieces of legislation, LC 590 and LC 592, copies of which I have brought with me today and I believe have also been distributed to you. These proposals were also attached as exhibits to the Council's November 30th, 2018 report, which was submitted to the legislature. In case you did not receive copies of the report, I have additional copies of that with me today as well. The first proposal, LC 590, would make the Council permanent, with staggered terms and the same statutorily set composition that currently exists. Under the current statute, the Council expires on January 1st, 2021. The continued existence of the Council, however, is important for several reasons. First, the Council, which is tasked under ORS 192 with making recommendations on changes in law, policy, or practice that could enhance transparency in public process and government and facilitate rapid dissemination of public records to requesters, is the best possible vehicle to make policy and legislative recommendations to the Legislative Assembly related to public records law. The Council is uniquely positioned to make insightful recommendations because it's composed of a variety of government and requester stakeholders. This allows the Council to make balanced proposals based on a broad array of experiences. The Council's unique composition also ensures the buy-in of all relevant parties before any policy proposals arrive at the legislature. In order to inform its policy proposals, the Council is also tasked with regularly gathering information on public records practices of government bodies across the state. This information gathering will inform not only the Council, but also the legislature, the public, and government officials in leadership positions. The Council is also an important oversight and guidance mechanism for the Public Records Advocate. Under ORS 192, the Public Records Advocate can only be removed for cause by the Governor or upon motion of the Public Records Advisory Council with the consent of the Governor. I regularly report to the Council on the activities of my office and receive the Council's advice and feedback on those activities. Council members have provided valuable feedback about budgetary concerns, effectiveness, and training practices. The council's varied composition makes it a particularly valuable provider of feedback. And because of this, ORS 192 specifically tasks the council with making recommendations on the role of the public records advocate. Additionally, the council is also responsible for adopting rules governing the operations of the Office of the Public Records Advocate. This important responsibility is core to the function of the office. Again, the council's composition makes it uniquely well-positioned to create balanced and thoughtful rules. Thus, in order to continue the reforms that began in 2017, it is important that the council be renewed in this piece of legislation. The council's second proposed piece of legislation, LC 592, creates four basic annual reporting requirements for state agencies on public records processing. By March 1st of each year, every state agency would have to submit to the Attorney General, the Public Records Advocate, and the Public Records Subcommittee of the Legislative Council Committee. One, the number of requests for records received by the agency in accordance with its public records policy applicable to that agency. Two, the number of requests for records received by the agency as reported in paragraph A of this subsection for which the agency has not completed its response by the date prescribed under ORS 192-329. That's the 15 business day timeline that was put in the statute in 2017. Three, the number of requests for records received by an agency as reported in paragraph A for which the agency that had not completed within 60 days of the date of the request. And four, the number of requests for fee waiver or reduction that the agency has granted and the number of requests for fee waiver or reduction that the agency has denied. Tracking this data will serve several purposes. There is currently a dearth of actual data regarding public records request practices in the state of Oregon. Even basic questions like how many requests were received by state agencies overall in the last calendar year are unanswerable. This reporting will inform the Council, the Office of the Public Records Advocate, the legislature, and the state and other state leaders about what legislative and policy changes are needed. It will also give the Office important information regarding what agencies and legal provisions should be the focus of training. And this data will help the legislature and other state leaders to identify what public bodies may need additional resources in order to improve public records performance. Additionally, this data will inform the public about agencies' public records processes and performance and will create accountability for state agencies. Transparency regarding public records performance will incentivize agencies to perform more efficiently and effectively, reducing costs for the agencies and improving customer service. These annual reporting requirements will involve minimal financial investment by state agencies. They are basic data points that can be tracked in a simple spreadsheet. In order to comply with the 15 business day deadline and in order to ensure proper processing of all requests, agencies should, in fact, already be tracking much of this data. In conversations with my office, many agencies have stated that they are already tracking similar data. In summary, this data, which can be gathered at minimal cost, will help to create well-informed policy proposals and ensure accountability. The Council would greatly appreciate your support on these two important legislative proposals. If you have questions or concerns, I would be happy to answer them at this time. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you much.
Thank you.
Adam.
Chair Riley, members of the committee, my name is Adam Crawford. I'm here today proudly representing DAS. We are bringing our laundry list of bills before you today just to otherwise try to gain any sort of insight as to what the committee may want or if there are any hard feelings around what we are bringing. By and large, we're going to start with 544. I hesitate to call this the housekeeping bill because anytime I heard housekeeping, I got very nervous. But essentially, we're trying to do six things within the context of LC 544. Taking it from the top, we are this committee, Senate Bill 91 came before this committee in 2017. This otherwise allowed the state to stop having to record travel awards that were otherwise awarded to state employees who were doing out-of-state travel. This frequently meant either per diem or frequent flyer miles. The reason we have to record this information is so those people can then transfer those rewards over to us as the state because we were the ones who paid for the travel. The problem comes in the amount of administrative back and forth around this. On our best year was 2010, we recouped about $5,000 worth of travel awards that we could then use to defray other out-of-state travel. Our worst year was 2013, where we recouped absolutely $0 in this. Rob Hamilton of DAS essentially functions as our state comptroller, and he basically surveyed the other agencies to figure out how much money it costs to do this report. And we think it's something on the order of about $100,000 to save $5,000. We are asking for your permission to not have to do this report anymore. The second thing this bill does is codify current custom and practice around the rental of building space. State agencies often use, other folks can come in to use meeting rooms or auditoria within state buildings. They pay a fee. This codifies current custom and practice around that. Also currently within statute, statute does not entertain the idea that the state could own a portion of a building. We could own a whole building or we could own no building, but there's no real issue around portions of buildings. 98% of the time, that's not an issue. We buy a whole building. The problem comes in the 2% of the time when we're trying to buy a floor or two floors in the metro area. We can't do it. The statute does not allow us to do it. This means we get locked into leases in essentially high dollar amounts. Other thing I would mention, we are asking for the ability to purchase portions of a building. There's a couple reasons we're excited about this. One, we think that it will drive down costs on a per foot basis. The second reason we're excited about it, I would probably reference you to Section 10 of the bill. Under current law, state buildings do not have to comply with local parking requirements. This was an end result of a fight about 40 years ago, basically centered around this building under Governor Attia. Essentially, with all of the buildings that the state government was building in the Capitol Mall area, the city of Salem was very unhappy with the state government because we weren't otherwise complying with local parking requirements, and the legislature exempted ourselves out. The negotiated peace that came out of that 1980 deal was the state agencies would otherwise still be exempt from local parking requirements. However, the state would contribute roughly on the order of between $20 and $25 million into mass transit associations within the affected cities. Generally, this is a function of how many people we have in a certain area. So we pay a lot of money to the Salem Chariots area. TriMet gets a fair bit of money, but depending upon how many state workers we have in an area, we dole out money. As a result, we think the state will be a very desired tenant, specifically in the Portland metro area, so they have to build less parking. The other thing, three other things this bill does. Sections 14 through 21 of this bill discuss liquid and delinquent debt. The legislature has done a tremendous amount of work over the last 4 years trying to get their arms around how much money is owed to the state. We think that the work continues. Specifically, the problem that these eight sections are trying to accomplish, when we get to semi-independent or quasi-independent agencies, depending upon how you read these eight different statutes, you could, if you are, for example, the Oregon Public Utility Notification Center, may have to report to us or maybe not, or maybe you have to report in this section but not in another section. We're trying to have one codified, simple definition of what a state agency is so all folks can know what you're reporting and what you're not reporting. We want to be clear, this does not currently apply to the Secretary of State, the Treasurer, the judicial branch. However, we are going to be asking for an amendment specifically regarding Section 16 of this bill. Right now, currently, the legislature reports to LFO how many liquid and delinquent debt accounts are currently on the books for the legislature. By and large, these are all found within the legislative administrative function of the building. Generally speaking, somewhere on the order between 8 and 10, generally speaking, less than 10 grand on a yearly basis. Currently, in the current draft of the bill, the legislature is exempt. That we are otherwise exempting the legislature from having to report that. We are going to be asking the legislature to exempt them, to remove that exemption and allow themselves to report to LFO. We as DAS then scoop that information and then pass it over to Department of Revenue.
So, Adam, if I can...
Please.
So what I gather is that you are exempting two executive department divisions and including a branch of government.
As of now, we are currently excluding the two different divisions and excluding the legislature as well. We are going to be asking that we include the legislature at the request of our accounts receivable folks.
I just want to make it clear that what you're doing is you're taking two divisions of the executive branch, excluding them from this requirement, and asking a separate branch of the government to be included. Is that what I hear?
That is correct.
Thank you very much.
The remaining two things that this bill does is around, one of them is around the Portland-Salem CPI indicator. The Portland-Salem CPI indicator appears in about 100 different places in statute. The problem is the Bureau of Labor Statistics stopped producing the Portland-Salem CPI indicator about 6 months ago. We are asking for a new indicator to be put into law. I would also direct the committee's attention to LC 3062. That's up in the Revenue Committee. While our bill only addresses two points of law, the 3062 LC addresses the, I think, roughly 98 other places in statute where the CPI indicator needs to be changed. The indicators that our bill brings and the one that 3062 brings is a little different. We have no strong opinions if the legislature would like to maintain uniformity, whether or not they use the revenue version or our version of the CPI indicator. Finally, Section 24 of the bill talks about a telecommuting report that DAS is required to produce. We are asked to produce a report that gives the number of people who are currently telecommuting within the state enterprise, the number of vehicle trips that they have saved, the miles that they would have traveled, their home addresses to and from where they may be going. The problem we are running into is we don't believe the information has a lot of validity or fidelity at this point. So we are asking instead that the statute otherwise reflect that we as DAS work to reduce the barriers to telecommuting across state enterprise. So that's our laundry list of a bill. Moving to LC 545, this bill is about lease purchasing. So DAS has the ability to enter into a lease purchase agreement for any building as long as that building is worth less than $100,000. The problem is very few buildings we have are worth less than $100,000. To give you a sense of scale, the whole enterprise of state government has about 6,500 facilities. Of those 6,500 facilities, we've got about 1,500 leases. Those 1,500 leases represent about 6 million square feet worth of leased space, and we are in turn paying roughly on the order of about $11 million every month in rent. We think we can get greater efficiencies than that, and part of the way we think we can do that is go through a lease purchase agreement process. This process would otherwise not lend the full faith and credit of the state. This, as long as there was a non-recourse provision within the contract, we are instead of lending the credit of the state, we are lending against the actual building we are trying to buy. We think we can get greater equity stakes within the buildings and otherwise arrange for greater taxpayer benefit on this. LC 564 addresses electric vehicle charging stations. It was Executive Order 1721 that the governor put out that requested the state to try to figure out a way to get roughly 50,000 electric vehicles on the road. Also within that executive order, DAS was asked to do what we can to make sure that happens. So this bill seeks to address that issue. Essentially, what we are asking for is a carve-out in procurement statute saying that we would have the ability to have one master procurement agreement where we could buy electric vehicle charging stations and the installation services to put them in. Normally, these processes would be decoupled, and they would be moved into two different longer procurement agreements. We're asking the ability to do it all under one. We're thinking that this would likely be a multi-award, multi-vendor agreement, different modules, different things that are necessary, and otherwise allowing state and local governments to come underneath this master agreement and purchase off this list. We think we can get greater efficiencies using this manner. Continuing our theme of executive orders, LC 547 discusses another facet of liquid and delinquent debt. Executive Order 1709 requires state agencies to consider when they are awarding contracts to a vendor, other non-tax debt that that vendor owes the state. We are asking that this executive order be put into statute. This is permissive language, otherwise allowing a state agency to consider these non-tax debts, not requiring them to. But we think it helps, again, keep our arms around our liquid and delinquent debt issues. Finally, we've got LC 548.
Before you move on, would that new statute be limited to just those particular things, as those electric vehicle charging stations?
When it comes to LC 546, yes. We are asking solely for electric vehicle charging. Finally, under LC 548, Senate Bill 1067, the cost containment bill, passed in 2017. Section 9 of that bill asks that 2% of the total current replacement value of all the state facilities be set aside in a deferred maintenance account. While we believe that this piece of legislation probably provides the implied authority to do what LC 548 is doing, we are asking for the explicit authority, essentially creating 20 different subaccounts for the 20 different agencies that can produce or can own real assets to have a deferred maintenance account where this 2% can go into. We think we probably have the implied authority under 1067. We just want to make it very clear that we are not going to be taking Ways and Means Appropriations, carving 2% off without the blessing of the legislature. The only other thing I would mention about this bill is this is the only bill that has an emergency clause on it that we are bringing. The reason for that is we need the bill to be in effect on July 1st, 2019. So when we get through the appropriation process, this money can go into a sub-account. So very happy to entertain any questions. I understand and appreciate your forbearance as we go through these very technical issues.
Questions for Adam?
Questions, sir.
Thank you. You have one? Go ahead.
Thank you. You mentioned Senate Bill 1067 in a way that makes me think you worked with it, looked it through pretty carefully, and I was just wondering if there's any summary of savings that you have on it, and, you know, hit its desired effect or findings.
Chair Riley, Senator Haas, at this point, I don't know of any, but I can certainly look into that and get back to you.
You don't know if there are any summaries or briefs?
Yeah. At this point, I don't know if there are.
Okay, thanks. That'd be great.
Yes, Senator
Haas. Chair, I was kind of curious about the frequent flyer program. I recall that, you know, when I was active duty Army, we flew a lot, both personal and, you know, according to the profession. And, you know, I racked up a lot of personal frequent flyer miles, and, you know, I was able to do the same thing when I, and there was never an indication saying that we had to roll over, turn those over to the Army, so that someone else can use those points or those mileage points. So I want, how did that work?
Essentially, Chair Riley, Senator Manning. Essentially, my understanding is the state of Oregon is a pretty big outlier when it comes to the federal government. When it comes to private corporations, they're not terribly interested in spending a dollar to chase a dime, and so when these travel awards are otherwise awarded, they don't spend a lot of time in their accounts receivable or accounts payable departments trying to chase people down to transfer them over to themselves. In very many cases, what we're finding when it comes to these awards, the credit card companies do not allow that transfer to happen. They go to a person and they stay with that person. And I know Rob, I'm sure, has an additional point.
Chair Riley, if I may, Senator Manning, there's actually a bit of history to this, and I'll explain, I think, why Oregon is a bit of an outlier, and it's based on our state ethics law. And so state ethics law basically says you can't earn additional money beyond your salary without being a violation, generally. There's exceptions and various things. And the way that state law has been interpreted means that if you acquire mileage, for example, that is a personal benefit to you and would violate state ethics law because you essentially got a personal advantage based on your employment. But the exception to that, even in Oregon, is this. And so far as I know, the state really doesn't use this exception, but some agencies do. The exception is you build that mileage into the base salary. So you recognize in personnel rule that those bonus mileage points are really kind of, at least in part, compensation for the toll it takes on employees to do all that travel. So you basically say, hey, we're just going to treat that as part of your salary, kind of as an equity issue. But the state of Oregon, as I understand it, the state as an agency generally doesn't do that. Where we do have other agencies, local agencies, that, you know, require their employees to do a lot of travel that in some cases pay, to be honest, substandard wages. So there's at least some little perk in requiring all that travel. I suspect the military has taken that position because they require military folks to travel. That's just my suspicion. But I think Oregon is rather not unique, but is kind of different in that sense that we have very strong state ethics laws.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions for anybody on the panel? Thank you very much. So we're going to move on to autonomous vehicles and Representative McLean. And anyone you want to bring with you?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you. Were you ready for me to start?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, first of all, my name is Susan McLean, and I am the representative from House District 29, which is in western Washington County, Hillsborough, Cornelius, and Forest Grove. And I had the fortune to be involved in a task force that was created in this last session, and it was House Bill 4063, and it produced a 31-member task force, and that 31-member task force was basically set up to help us navigate through some of the issues that we have in the state as we are setting up to deal with autonomous vehicles on our roads. And this task force has worked for about 8 months now. We started in May, and we met quite a few times, and we had some duties from the House bill that basically asked us to look at some of the basic types of things that we would be interested in and looking at to make sure that our roadways are safe for folks who are sharing those roadways. And whether it be a pathway to school or whether it be a freeway or whether it be a local road, that if we were going to have a combination of pedestrians and bikers and trucks and cars that were automated and cars that were not automated, that we had to make sure that they were able to follow the rules of the road and they were able to make sure that our communities were safe in every way, shape, and form. They decided to put together in the first go-around four subcommittees, and those subcommittees included law enforcement and crash reporting. It included a second subcommittee, licensing and registration. Insurance and liability was the third, and then cybersecurity and long-term policy issues that would then be continued on in a second go-around and a second report. The first report was due in September 15th, and if you are interested in reading that report, it is, I can get you the link for that, and it has appendix to it that were from some of the 27 members that were from industry, from environmental groups, from public agencies, from government officials, giving some information as far as their, you know, their take on what was going on. We have a bill that's coming up in this session from that committee work, and the bill itself is a framework for testing in the state of Oregon, taking all of the areas where there was agreement on testing and putting it together in a framework to make sure that we can change statutes that would have to be change to allow for testing and being able to follow the rules of the road in the state of Oregon. Now, that was year one, and it was the first go-around, and the result was this bill. The bill was given out at the last subcommittee meeting in the first week of December to look at, to make sure that our drafter had done a good job of keeping together the coalition on those issues from those four subcommittees that I just named for you. But what the one of the subcommittees, which was cybersecurity and long-term effects of autonomous vehicles, we knew we had more work to do as we were going toward the topic of deployment. And some of those issues that are out there, I believe you will talk about one of them in and highlight, and that is dealing with worker displacement, and really dealing with how it affects workers and how it affects training for folks that may not be doing the same job in the future that they do now. And we agreed that in this, you'll see in the framework bill that's coming in 2019, that we agreed to do some actual reports and do some studies that were on those issues. And so at this meeting that we had in the first week of December to kind of set up what we want to cover in the second report and what we want to cover on the areas of taking us smoothly from testing into deployment eventually, what are some of the things that we need to do? And the first thing we agreed to was to conduct an independent workforce study and determine, secondly, insurance requirements and address liabilities that are issues that deal specifically with deployment and usage in that stage. Issuing also AV policies further Oregon's existing goals and objectives, and making sure that the transportation goals, the land use goals, the greenhouse gas emission goals, and the economic development goals are all able to be met. And this will be continuing on in some of the subcommittee work this year. We also wanted to look at sharing useful information and data with public interested individuals and purposes, both at, for a lot of different reasons. We do research gathering and making sure that the proprietary elements of the industry are kept intact, but that we do have information as we use this new type of technology on our roads and we find out what are some of the challenges and what are some of the benefits so that we can go forward and continue to improve the systems. The task force just this last week did a brainstorm meeting, and the workforce there was really reiterated as being important in that study and report. And also, we also talked about making subgroups, and we think there are about seven that we should have. And one is how autonomous vehicles affects land use. Second was roads and infrastructure design, because we know it's going to affect our infrastructure design and also the cost and the systems that we'll have to have in place in the future. Public transit and how autonomous vehicles, there's autonomous transit vehicles, but also how the last mile and trying to get people from transit in a home when they don't have the last station close to your house and you've got to walk that last mile, and how autonomous vehicles might fit into that. Workforce changes and needs, and cybersecurity, privacy, and data was put into the sixth subcommittee. We think they relate. We may have to call out some of those information areas, but we think at this point that there's an overlapping responsibility there to look at some of the data needs in a number of different areas. And then also the last subcommittee that was added was amendments to the vehicle code for deployment and public safety, and what are some of those issues as we go toward that pathway of deployment and out of the framework of actual just testing. So I wanted to be able to come today to support Mark stating that we have industry and we have a lot of interaction between different types of industry that are really going to be affected as these autonomous vehicles become a reality worldwide, nationwide, and also in the state of Oregon. But we want to make sure that we do it in a measured way. We want to make sure that we've taken into consideration all of the issues to make sure that we can have any vehicle that's on our road following the rules of the road, and also that we are not standing in the way of industry as they are trying to go forward and test technology that has a lot of potential benefit as well as potential challenges that we'll have to deal with. So I'm just here as a general overview, and if you have any questions about that overview or about the bill, if you'd like a copy of the bill as we're working on this last copy of it, I'm happy to have my office connect with you and your office, and I'm just here to answer questions now.
So could you be sure and get that link that you talked about to the administrator so she can give it to the committee members?
Absolutely.
Mr. McPherson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak to you. I'm Mark McPherson. I'm the political coordinator for Joint Council of Teamsters number 37 of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. We obviously represent everybody in the supply chain, transportation industry from start to finish. We represent manufacturing, we represent warehousing, we represent transit on every level. We represent about 23,000 members in the state of Oregon, and we feel that the majority of our members will be impacted in some way by autonomous vehicle technology. And we have concerns for our membership and how that may apply. I like to point out that if you look at the Teamster emblem, which you can't see on my lapel, but it's a wagon wheel and two horses' heads, right? I mean, we're the Teamsters Union. We started with team drivers. That was where we began. And we have adapted with technology as we have gone to the automobile, as we have gone to interstate highway systems and just triple trailer trucks and everything. I mean, we have always been able to adapt and represent our members. Autonomous vehicles probably pose another dynamic challenge that we're going to have to work with. We have all witnessed, and just recently, a desire to among states to lure tech industries to their states. I mean, we witnessed this last Amazon headquarters incredible event where people were changing street names and doing all kinds of things to draw Amazon to their cities. And I think when you have this real lust to bring technology to communities and an industry that stands to really profit from the advancement of this technology, it creates a real fertile ground for bringing technology to your community. And it also brings a fertile ground to bring this without even considering the consequences. And in Oregon, there's about 45,500 truck driving jobs at all levels, heavy trucking, industrial trucking, light trucking, delivery trucking. And that number is expected to grow by about 13% in the next 10 years. We have concerns with the deployment of this technology, in that it's not just we're not just talking about displacing truck drivers, but once you have a trucking company, let's say that utilizes this technology, it will certainly impact their drivers. You know, if they take the driver out of the vehicle, it's going to impact the driver. But it also impacts their competitors, who may still retain drivers in their vehicles, because now it's about 30% of the cost of freight is the cost of labor. So if a company can reduce their costs by 30% by taking out a driver, that puts significant downward pressure on the other competitors to reduce the wages and benefits and working conditions of their drivers. And so we see that as a huge threat as well. The other thing we are concerned about is sort of the ripple effect that this technology will have. It's not just going to impact truck drivers. It could potentially impact warehousers. Warehouses are set up strategically across the nation, so they're close to their retail outlets or to metro centers. This model was created by Sears Roebuck, actually, 100 years ago. They set up 8 distribution centers, so when you order something through a catalog, you can get it in a relatively short period of time. That has been the extreme model of that now is Walmart, who has distribution centers no more than a day's drive for a trucker from their distribution centers. If you can drive a truck now for 24 hours a day without rest breaks or meal breaks or anything, that means you could consolidate warehouses and have fewer warehouses, move them farther apart because it doesn't take so long to get the freight there. Another concern I would have is the communities that rely on the trucking industry. I mean, just driving here from Portland, you pass 2 or 3 exits where there are small communities that have really perhaps a potential source of income for those communities is a Love's truck stop or a TA travel center, a Denny's restaurant, and a Super 8 motel. And that's business that comes from trucking. That's not mom and dad in the station wagon. That's trucking business. I don't know how many of you have ever been to a TA travel center, but let me say they sell clothing, sunglasses, books on tape. You know, I mean, it is geared just for trucking. And because of this, and because of our concerns, and our recognition that this technology is coming, what we would really like to see is we think that legislators should not vote on this legislation or consider this legislation without really realizing the impact that this technology could have on communities and on workers in this state. And so we would ask that prior to moving legislation over the edge, that we have a study on the impact on workers conducted by the state for all legislators to see. I would also encourage that, and this would be our ask, is that we take into consideration a plan for dealing with displaced workers, because displaced workers are going to happen. And I will tell you, the knee-jerk reaction I've gotten is, oh, well, let's do a job retraining program. And the average truck driver for our membership is probably in their 50s, maybe 55 years old, and they've been driving a truck for 30 years, and they have no more than a high school education. What are you going to train a 55-year-old guy who has no more than a high school education to do, and how are you going to maintain that he stays in the middle class? We need a comprehensive plan that will help displaced workers remain in the middle class and remain productive workers, whether that's, you know, low interest loans or put them on the Oregon Health Plan or something. But I think we need a comprehensive plan to deal with displaced workers. And I think lastly, I'll say that the other concern we have is I submitted, along with my testimony here, three documents, actually. Two of them are our worker impact studies. One was commissioned by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters at our international level. It's a national study that deals with the impact on workers. And we recognize that we'd like to have something a little more localized. So in cooperation with the AFL-CIO and Amalgamated Transit Workers, the Teamsters commissioned a study on the impact on workers. I'd encourage you all to take a look at that as well. Both of the studies indicate that there could be new jobs created through automation, and our concern is, and I don't want to get into total weeds on the studies, but there could be last mile delivery jobs created, and our fear is that, and this is the fear expressed in both studies, is that new jobs created could lend themselves to the independent contractor model that a lot of ports use. And so I see that as creating lower quality jobs. These are terrible jobs, some of these jobs. And so what I would encourage us to do is consider legislation that deals with the misclassification of workers. I would like to see us do what we can to strengthen up so that these new jobs, when they come, that they're good jobs and they're as good of jobs as what we have lost. Do I have any questions?
Questions? No, I don't think so. Thank you very much.
Could I make a comment?
Absolutely.
One of the things that I think it was important for us both to be here today was the fact that one of the things that this committee has done for me is Mark and I are on a reading program together, and he's done a really good job of sending information about automation in a variety of different places, in a variety of different ways, and in a variety of ways that affect other things. And so I acknowledge and I support the idea that we need to be thorough as we look forward in our technology worlds on what the implications are, and specifically what are the ramifications for certain jobs or for certain aspects of our community or for our environment or for our land use or anything else. And I think that the one thing you need to feel secure in is that the bill that we passed last session, which was House Bill 4063, did just that, where we made an absolute commitment as a legislature to go through this process of making sure that we looked at all of these issues, including the ones that I talked about and the ones that Mr. McPherson talked about today. And I make a commitment and my responsibility in helping work through that with all of the partners and all of the different groups that are interested in this, that we are able to do it in a thorough way and in a real way. I will say one thing, though, and that is we all know that time doesn't stand still and that technology is changing every single minute. And that what we're trying to make sure we do with the first section or legislation is that we have a framework to do some of this work in, and that we are taking on our due diligence of making sure that we're taking care of the safety on our roadways in a way of making sure that any vehicle that's on the roadway can actually be made to follow the rules of the road or get the exceptions that they need in an appropriate way to be able to do their job as industry as well. And so that's why working together, that's what we're trying to do right now. And we're taking very seriously the items that Mr. McPherson has talked about, and we have made a commitment to doing that study. And so I appreciate that you took some time today to hear about this endeavor, this task force, and some of this work that's ahead of us. It's not one and off, and it's not a quick bill and be done. It's the fact that we're going to be dealing with this type of new technology for the next 40, 50 years, and then it'll be something else, right? So, but thank you for letting us come today.
Mr. Chair, may I make one more quick comment?
Sure, absolutely.
I was just going to just say that back to regard to having a plan to deal with displaced workers, I think that this is something we need to be ahead of. I think once the workers start to be displaced, it's a very difficult fix at that point. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to be in front of it.
That makes perfect sense to me. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
So if there's no other questions, I'm going to end that informational meeting. Thank you very much. And anything for the good of the order? So I'm closing this committee. Thank you very much.